Greetings, sensationalists from across the fruity plains.
You're listening to the Andy Finn Show,
a smooth talk of the town.
Cool. Yes, you are. Welcome back to the Andy Finn Show on WEBR Radio. And we're taking a quick look at the campaigns. Here we are, mid-November, and while they still have not set the final date for the New Hampshire primary, can you believe this? It sounded like a Mideast Peace Conference. We got a Mideast Peace Conference taking place next week in Annapolis sometime, except we don't know, or I'm sorry, not next week, the week after, yeah, next week, the week after Thanksgiving, except that we don't know what day exactly, we don't know what the topics are, we don't know how long it's going to last, and we don't know who's invited. And when I say we, I mean the Bush administration hasn't finalized all those decisions. But as soon as they do, they're going to let everybody involved know, and then they'll let us know. It's kind of like that, because we don't know for sure when all these primaries are being held, and yet there's quite a bit of prep work to do. So the New Hampshire Attorney General, I believe, is the guy that gets final say on the date. He's just hedging his bets in case anybody else moves their primary. But right now we're looking at early January for the start of these early races, and then Super Tuesday is February 5th, I guess it is, and that's the day when something like 35% of the delegates to both Republican and Democratic conventions get handed out. And it may be more than 35%, but it's a huge chunk of them. They think they may know who's going to win by February 5th. And they announced today what the dates of the debates are. The commission that sets up the debates has laid them down, and there's a debate in September and two in October and a vice presidential debate, a single debate in October. These are 90-minute debates. So we go from February, maybe it'll be March before we know for sure who wins the nominations in each party. But we've got, let's assume it's settled in early, sometime in March, we've got April, May, June, July, August, most of September. Almost 6 months before we get to the serious part of the campaign, and yet we know who the candidates are. It's going to be a long, slow summer. It's hard to believe we're still a year away, because it feels like we've been in this campaign almost a year, and we have. Anyway, back to the Giuliani campaign. Again, I don't do this to you folks every week. In fact, occasionally there's an interesting campaign story worth taking up, and I haven't talked about the campaign in a number of weeks. So the Giuliani Carrick story, I guess that's really just part of the Giuliani New York story. It's going to come back any number of ways, the number of things that Giuliani has done, tried to do, that he's put his spin on it. You know, he's America's mayor and his valiant stand post 9/11. But there's a whole other side to that that we've talked about briefly here before, and there's plenty of people in New York that have written about it. The firefighters are not on his side, and it'll be interesting to see if he can hold the man, the myth, together. I mentioned Tom Tancredo before, and he has an interesting commercial out. He had one out last week, and this was the ultimate fear appeal. Now, we know the Republicans are waging a campaign of fear. That is their primary weapon in the 2008 campaign. Virtually all of them basically say, we need to be more afraid than we are. You need to elect Republicans to keep you safe. The terrorists are coming to get us. You know, fight them over there before they get here. Even though there's not a lot of evidence, if we hadn't gone into Iraq, we'd have had attacks on our soil. But that's the argument. So in this ad that Tancredo put out last week, he basically, of course, he's anti-immigration, and most people now are using national security as a club to add to the immigration issue. They want to stop illegal aliens coming across the border, but they couch it in terms of national security. That, you know, if we don't stop Hispanics from coming over, we'll have terrorists sneaking in with them. Which, well, it's possible. They're going to have to learn Spanish first to fit in, aren't they? Anyway, he shows, Tancredo shows, in an ad that appears in Iowa now, a man with a hooded sweatshirt goes into a shopping mall, sets down a backpack next to a bench, and he walks away, and the backpack explodes. And then there's the quote. There are consequences to open borders beyond the 20 million aliens who have come to take our jobs. Islamic terrorists now freely roam U.S. soil. Jihadists who froth with hate here to do as they have in London, Spain, and Russia. The price we pay for spineless politicians who refuse to defend our borders against those who come to kill. Then they have the explosion, and the closing words on the screen are, Tancredo, before it's too late. And he started with, I approve this message because somebody needs to say it. So, man, this is the ultimate fear appeal. I think Giuliani's got enough of a fear appeal, but Tancredo takes it to the next level. He has no chance to get the nomination, thank goodness. But even Giuliani's rhetoric is unbelievable. I think he's, basically what he says is the Democrats aren't serious about national security. I will go after the terrorists where they live. I'll hunt them down, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, he's upset serious people like Joe Biden so much that Biden said at the last debate. Now, keep in mind, Biden's been in the Senate for 28 years and is chairman of the Armed Services Committee. So he knows a bit about national defense. He was right about Iraq 4 years ago when he said the only way around this is a loose federation where you essentially, they don't like the word partition, but you have local people govern their areas and keep them apart. But Biden said that Giuliani's not qualified to be president, the least qualified person to be president that's run for president since George W. Bush ran. And he cracked a good joke where he said that there's only three things that Giuliani ever says, a noun, a verb, and 9/11. And Giuliani fired back and said, oh, yeah, well, you're a plagiarizer, man. Because 20 years ago when he ran for the presidency in 1988, Joe Biden lifted words from a speech by Neil Kinnock, a member of parliament in the UK. And it caused Biden to drop out of the race at that point. Anyway, enough about Giuliani for this week. Let's move on to Fred Thompson. Fred Thompson is a really strange candidate. First of all, he's got the same problem Giuliani does. He's bald. And as you know, if you've listened to me, I've already declared that we don't elect bald people. Dick Cheney aside, right, he was on the vice presidential ticket, and we needed a father figure to convince people that George W. Bush would be somebody to be watching what George W. Bush did in office. But in general, you know, the campaign of Phil Graham, it didn't go very far. Again, another conservative Republican from Texas, Phil Graham never caught on. And so I don't see Fred Thompson getting the nomination. But it goes beyond the fact that Thompson may not have the fire in the belly, as they say. It's not clear that he wants to work hard enough or that he wants it bad enough. And you have to want the presidency, or you don't get it. You have to work pretty hard. But he jumps into all these issues. He jumped into Social Security a couple of weeks ago to say that he would raise retirement ages. Well, you know, the common logic is that doesn't do you any good in your campaign to promise people that you're going to take something away from them. He gets credits for honesty, but in general, honesty doesn't get you elected. I'm not saying we shouldn't have more of it. I'm just saying he's going against his advisor's advice, I'm quite sure. This week, and by this week I mean over the weekend, yesterday on ABC's This Week, they interviewed Thompson, and he jumped into the Terri Schiavo case. Now, in general, you wouldn't think that you'd want to go back and revisit that if you could. I mean, if you could avoid it. But he jumps in and he takes a position on the Terri Schiavo case. And he said, quote, I would side with the parents in, you know, keeping that child alive. How could you decide otherwise if they told you that the child was going to continue to live? Well, who told him that? When you say continue to live, Again, it's a persistent vegetative state. And then he goes on to say that when family members cannot agree, the first recourse needs to be the state government. I guess this was in reaction to the fact the federal government got involved last time. But what he's missing here is, he might have slept through the whole Schiavo case, but to take you back, the state court, the state of Florida decided it went all through the courts. There were numerous appeals. Her husband, who was now getting divorced, whatever it was, he was also living with another woman. My first impression of the guy was that he wasn't looking out for her. But the husband had accepted the medical advice, knowledge, understanding that had come from the various CAT scans and the experts who said that there was no person there anymore, that her massive hemorrhage, or whatever they called her injury, had destroyed most of her brain, and that, well, it looked like she was reacting to what people were doing, and she blinked, and she could look like she was aware. There just was no one there. The person that was Terri Schiavo was gone, and the brain was destroyed, so destroyed that she would never be there again, although she could be kept alive indefinitely physically. Her parents didn't want to pull the plug, understandable for parents. So 8 years in a coma and 8 years winding through the courts, the courts finally said, you know, the husband is the final authority here. He's closest to the wife. What he wants takes precedent over what the parents want. That's what happens when you can't get agreement. And so he was, from the point of view of a lot of people, mercifully going to pull the plug and stop the pretense that there was any chance she would ever recover. They had done the CAT scans. At the time that it became clear that he was going to be allowed to pull the plug, the media jumps in and the conservatives jump in and the Right to Life crowd jumps in. And I still remember Sean Hannity from Hannity and Combs going down there and shamelessly interviewing the family and making the husband the bad guy, and talking to the parents and talking to Terri Schiavo's sister and making the claims, the outrageous claims that with the sister, allowing the sister to assist him in making the claims that the husband had abused her physically, and that when they did an autopsy, if they pull the plug and do the autopsy, they'll find that she had broken bones. And when they do the autopsy, they'll find that her brain was fine. And he just, for a couple of weeks, he shamelessly promoted this. And then the Florida state legislature jumps in, and the federal government jumps in, the Congress jumps in, and they call a special session, and they finally get something done in a hurry. And Bush flies back from Texas to sign the bill, to have them take one more look at this, when it had been done to death, and the experts, the medical experts, had all looked at it. And Bill Frist, the doctor, jumps in and says, yeah, I saw the videotape they sent me. They spliced a few minutes out of 6 hours of video that made it look like she was reacting to things they were doing. And he diagnoses from the videotape, after serious experts had studied this in depth, medical experts, and made their own determination. Frist jumps in with an off-the-cuff analysis. I mean, it was all pretty outrageous and pretty silly. And when the Republican Congress got done, the country was against him. The country understood what was going on. The polls were running wildly against the Republicans on this. And Terri Schiavo's husband was allowed to pull the plug, her ex-husband now, you could say. And mercifully, that episode came to an end. And I understand that people are passionate about life, but you know, people have a right to die in this country, too. And when I get to a certain age, and my quality of life is almost nothing, I don't want people keeping me alive for another 2 years just because there's a machine that can keep me alive. If I got no quality of life, no ability to enjoy it, let's pull the plug, and if there's any money left, don't give it to the nursing home. Go out and have a party. So Fred Thompson jumps into this mess again and says, We should keep her alive, and the first recourse needs to be the state government. It was the state government. It wound through the courts completely. That's when it made national news, is when they were getting ready to finally pull the plug. You know, we pull the plug on people in this country every day of the year. What happens is the family's in agreement, and the family says, yes, that's the right thing to do. And when they have agreement, they pull the plug, and no one hears about it. Why aren't people out there trying to say, no, don't pull their plugs either? Even just because everyone in the family agrees, if Terri Schiavo should have been kept alive, all these people should be kept alive. I never understood why they don't get that. Anyway, the final piece of the Terri Schiavo puzzle, of course, was that when they did the autopsy, she had no broken bones. Sean Hannity was making it up to justify his position, claiming that her husband was a monster that beat her physically and broke her bones. No broken bones. No signs of abuse over the years of his former wife. And her brain was mostly gone. The autopsy showed that it was destroyed. So the medical authorities were absolutely right. Did Sean Hannity ever apologize? No, he still talks about that case as though he were right. Another conservative having trouble dealing with reality. Which is interesting because that's the issue that came up with Brit Hume talking about Iraq yesterday. And I suppose we'll get to this, let's say, after the break.
Hi, I'm Andy Finn. You know, even if someone handed me $1 million this morning, I'd still be doing my radio show on WEBR. Why? Because I have commitment. I have dedication. Plus, I signed a contract. Now, if you'll do the same, I'll have one more dedicated listener. Don't worry, you can void your contract if I ever get obsessed with liberals, or gays, the flag, the pledge, embryonic stem cells, the UN, illegal immigrants, missing white women, or the country of France. So tune in the Andy Finn Show on WEBR, Mondays at 10 p.m. Hey, if you had $1 million, you could buy a radio station.
Yes, you could, but I don't, so I won't. We are back on the Andy Finn Show, and we're on WEBR Radio in Fairfax, Virginia. Hey, when we talk about the Democratic candidates, the first name that always comes up is Hillary Clinton. And who would you believe if you're a Democrat, or if you're looking for Hillary's chances, who would you believe, another Democrat or a Republican? Well, here's an interesting juxtaposition. John Edwards and Dick Armey both weighed in on Hillary's chances. John Edwards, of course, Democrat. He'll support the nominee, the eventual nominee, whoever it is, against whoever the Republican is. And Dick Armey, former, let's see, what was his position? He's a former congressman from Texas, of course. And I believe he was head of, he was never Speaker of the House. What was he? Majority Whip? I forget. Anyway, he was a big wheel among the Republicans, and he retired after about 18 years in Congress. And he will eventually support the Republican nominee, whoever it is, against the Democrat. Edwards was asked if Hillary Clinton can win. And here's what he said. This was over the weekend. I think that remains to be seen. That's why we have campaigns. I mean, what I know is that I can, that is, he can win. And I think the empirical evidence supports this. Well, I don't know what empirical evidence he has that he can win. Empirical meaning evidence in the real world. Polls? Polls don't show him being able to beat Giuliani by, let's say, more than Hillary can beat Giuliani. But what's interesting is that he claims he doesn't know if Hillary can beat the Republican nominee. But it turns out Dick Armey does know. Dick Armey was asked about this, and because he's out of politics, he can be honest. He said that Hillary Clinton was, quote, the most able politician in America, and that she'd win the presidential election in 2008. This was at a luncheon presentation that he was at, and he said, I don't think Hillary Clinton's going to make a mistake. She's going to win that election. He called her a fascinating person, said she's extremely tough, and the advice she gave other candidates was, don't mess with her. I have to admit, I do like Armey. I disagree with him a lot of the times, but when you catch him on Hardball or some other show, he will tell you what he thinks more than most politicians. And this was true when he was still in the House. Now I think he's telling you even more. But interesting. So Edwards isn't sure she's going to win. Of course, he says that so he can have a better chance of being nominated. And it's interesting, the narrative that we've had about the whole Hillary nomination thing, because what happened with the whole the reaction to the last couple of debates, when Hillary had a minor slip in the last debate, the debate in Philadelphia, where she stumbled over the question of licenses for illegal immigrants and couldn't give a straight answer, and people jumped on that. Everybody smelled blood, supposedly. Well, she's so far ahead, realistically, it wasn't going to cost her that much. But the press needs a horse race. It's like watching an NFL game. If you're watching Monday Night Football and the Packers are leading the Bears 31-3, it looks like the game is over, and yet we're early in the third quarter, and the announcer's job is to make it interesting. So they have to talk about how the Bears outscore their opponents in the third and fourth quarter, almost 2-1, and that the Bears are really a second-half team, and that they're starting to hit their stride, and they have to convince the audience to stay tuned in, and this game might get close. That's what announcers are supposed to do when they're announcing a blowout. Well, the announcers who are covering the press who are covering the election are basically covering a blowout. Hillary was ahead by more than 20 points just a week or two ago. Now, it is true the gap is closed some, and I'm not sure whether it's a self-fulfilling prophecy on the part of the media or what, but I just think it's interesting that everyone so wanted a horse race that they said, in that last debate, you know, what was going to have to happen? They'll have to attack Hillary, et cetera. And then the announcers helped them. Russert and Brian Williams came out. Of course, Brian Williams is leans towards the Republican side of things. He'll ask tough questions of Democrats, but throws softballs to Rudy. But even Russert joined in, and they started off by giving Obama the first pitch and said, basically, we have a question for you, Senator Obama. Would you like to attack Hillary Clinton? It was almost that bad. So, anyway, Hillary survived the debate, and now they've had another one, and apparently the media has decided that she had a strong debate, and so she's quieted down all this talk about her losing the nomination. We shall see. Now, she has had a couple of other things come up. There was the issue of the tip, if you didn't hear about this. Hillary and her group stopped in to a restaurant in Iowa and had lunch. And the waitress that waited on Hillary got interviewed by NPR. I covered this last time, I think, 2 weeks ago. And NPR went back 2 weeks later, like, to talk to people, and they just wanted to see, what was your impression of the candidate? Now that all the hubbub has died down, what's your impression? And they didn't mean to break this story, but the waitress said, well, she didn't leave me a tip. So they just reported that. I mean, NPR handles these things pretty straight. They weren't looking to make Hillary look bad particularly. That's what came out of the story, so they weren't going to bury it. Contrary to the opinions on the right, the people who are paranoid about this kind of thing, NPR does not go out there with a left-right political agenda trying to promote one candidate and hurt another. If the, you know, what's interesting is, had the Giuliani campaign had the same kind of a thing where a waitress said he didn't leave me a tip and NPR reported it, the first thing the conservatives would say is, well, NPR is biased against Giuliani. You didn't hear him say that about Hillary, did you? And it turns out that the campaign had dropped a $100 tip on a $157 tab, but given it to the manager to distribute among the employees, and the waitress didn't get hers. I haven't heard the end of that story and whether or not the manager confirmed it. He immediately came out and said, well, we distributed that tip, but he never confirmed that he was handed $100. It'd be hilarious if they found out that the manager kept about 50% of it for himself or more. Anyway, back to the campaign issue. When it came out that they dropped a $100 tip on a tab of $157, conservative pundits came out and started accusing them of being too extravagant and showing off and throwing around campaign money. This is hard-earned dollars that someone's giving to the campaign, and that's how you're spending it? I just think it's hilarious that people are, you know, you can't do anything right. If she'd left a 20% tip, people would have said, why can't you be more generous? Anyway, there are people out there were asking about the tip. But the last thing that happened, the more recent thing that happened, was there was a staged question. Someone in the Clinton campaign asked a waitress to ask a question. Not a waitress, sorry. Asked a young woman, to ask a question about global warming. And I don't want to make too much of this because I think that chances are Hillary gets a question about global warming every so often anyway. But the campaign is trying to steer it the way they want. I don't think there'll be any lasting damage. I wouldn't be surprised if we find out other campaigns are doing that. But it does, Hillary's problem is it does play into the stereotype that, and the narrative, that she's too pre-programmed and planned. Everything is scripted. And of course, if you get the questions you want, that would be more scripting. Anyway, let's talk about a couple of the other before we get to the other candidates, we should point out that in the last debate, Barack Obama got asked about licenses for illegals, and he hemmed and hawed and had trouble coming up with a straight answer, but he eventually did say he's in favor of giving him the licenses. So again, he's looking for the nomination. So that's what some people would describe as a typical Democratic response. It's how you would deal with it in a big city, like Giuliani tried to deal with illegals by, you know, getting along, and how Elliot Spitzer, the Democratic governor of New York, is trying to deal with them to deal with the state issue of, gee, do we want these people driving around without licenses and without planning? But Obama had trouble with the question. Meanwhile, Hillary clarified her answer, and Spitzer himself, the backlash was so strong on immigration that Elliot Spitzer came out and he's dropped his plans to give licenses to illegals. And now Hillary says she wouldn't do it either. So she's finally on, quote, the right side of the issue as far as, I don't know, I guess you'd say swing voters are concerned, because it's not going to hurt her tremendously with Hispanics. She's got the Hispanic vote compared to a Republican who is going to be anti-illegal immigration. But this issue probably won't hurt her too much. It remains to be seen. But I just thought it was all pretty interesting. And immigration is an issue that is going to be tough for either party to deal with. And it's just one of those wedge issues that you cannot please everybody, and you can't really split the loaf in the same way in the same way you can't split the loaf on abortion. It's not like, well, we'll instead of approving the amount you want versus the amount I want, we'll split the difference. We shall see. In any case, I guess the other thing I wanted to chat about, we'll talk about after we come back from this break, but it really comes down to the fact that there is a perception out there about women that Hillary is dealing with that may in the long run cost her. We'll see about this. But when we come back, we're going to talk about the impressions people have of women as leaders.